This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the Ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَمَا تَكُونُ فِي شَأْنٍ وَمَا تَتْلُو مِنْهُ مِنْ قُرْآنٍ وَمَا تَتْلُو وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater. But it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says the use of unilateral sanctions as political leverage impedes humanitarian work across the globe. Multiple civilian fatalities are reported in Ukraine's latest shelling of downtown Donetsk. Also coming up, the US planning to boost its rational military presence in Australia. Welcome to World News Live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Now, top story, Iran has once again condemned the imposition of unilateral sanctions by some countries against others and their use as political leverage in bilateral relations between states. Iran's deputy ambassador to the United Nations made the remark while addressing a General Assembly meeting on humanitarian aid. She described unilateral sanctions as a major obstacle to international humanitarian efforts. Iranian diplomats added that such sanctions are also a breeding ground for all kinds of human crises across the globe. She also voiced Iran's concern about deviation of humanitarian aid as well as non-humanitarian activities undertaken under the guise of humanitarian aid. And Iran says it has dismantled a number of operational cells affiliated with the MKO terrorist organization. In a statement, the intelligence ministry said the cells of saboteurs were smashed in the provinces of Tehran, Isfahan, and Kurdistan. It said the elements of those cells were arrested, adding that they were involved in terrorist activities and mortar attacks on Iran's administrative, military, police, and residential centers. The ministry said those terror activities caused damage and insecurity in the country. It noted that all those cells were directly guided by European base of the MKO terrorist group located in Albania. The intelligence ministry also reported the confiscation of a huge cache of weapons and equipment used by the terrorists. Iran says the recent riots in the country were fomented through foreign interference and represented a hybrid war against the Iranian people. Now Western countries, the US in particular, are trying to pressure Tehran by using human rights as a pretext for removing Iran from the UN Commission on the Status of the Women. Tehran has slammed the move, calling it illegitimate.
Tehran has slammed Washington's move to push a draft resolution aimed to remove Iran from the UN's Commission on the Status of Women. Iran's foreign ministry says any misuse of the internal developments in Iran to exert political pressure on the country is condemned and unacceptable. Iran has just started a four-year term on the body after a recent voting session by the UN Economic and Social Council. Tehran has repeatedly warned that some Western countries are exploiting human rights for their own political ends. In recent weeks, rioters went on the rampage across the country, brutally attacking security officers and causing massive damage to public property as Western powers, especially the United States, provided support. The European Union and some Western countries have imposed sanctions on Iran over its approach toward the riots. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said that the US and certain European countries are behind the political and illegal draft resolution and that they are seeking to exert pressure on independent countries to pass it. He said the US move is an action against the free vote of countries in international organizations and structures and questions the legality of such mechanisms in international bodies. He added, there are member countries of the UN Security Council or the Human Rights Council and Human Rights Assemblies that committed countless crimes against governments and independent nations throughout their history and now use human rights tools to exert pressure. Iran has lashed out at Western officials for cheering rioters in independent states while suppressing peaceful protesters in their own countries. Iran's foreign ministry says countries that have coups, conspiracies, interventions, and devastating wars with millions of deaths in their history are now pretending to be defenders of human rights in other countries. The best example would be Western countries' hypocritical behavior vis-a-vis protests in Iran and their own states. Western officials say the protests in Britain, Germany, France, Canada, and Australia are bad and deserve severe confrontation, but riots in their targeted countries are good and deserve support.
Iranian officials have criticized the U.S. over its push for removing Iran from the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women, saying that they are acting dictatorially under the name of women's rights. Tehran has vowed to use all of its political and diplomatic capacities to prevent that move.
The riots in Iran began after the death of a young woman named Mahsa Amini in September. She collapsed at a police station in Tehran and later died at a hospital. Since then, the issue of women's rights suddenly caught the imagination of the world. The self-proclaimed human rights champions in the West who turn a blind eye to gross human rights abuses in the US and Europe are accusing Iranian authorities of killing the woman, even though all evidence, including the forensic report, scoffs at those claims. The Islamic Republic has strongly censured several countries for provoking riots in the country through their spy agencies and propaganda apparatus. London, in particular, hosts several anti-Iranian networks, including Iran International, Manoto, and BBC Persian. The U.S. is pushing for the removal of Iran from the UN Commission on the Status of Women following trumped-up claims by foreign media that attributed the killing of women to the Iranian government during the recent unrest in the country. They claim that they are acting in defense of women's rights, but they are in fact violating those rights and preventing women from raising their issues through pushing for the removal of Iran from the UN Commission. The 54-member UN Economic and Social Council is expected to vote on December 14th whether to oust Iran from the Commission or not.
Anti-Iran media networks are reporting a three-day strike by Iranian shopkeepers as part of the recent unrest in the country. But in Tehran, shops remain open and people are busy shopping these days, our correspondent reports.
According to foreign-based news channels, a three-day strike was supposed to sweep across the country from Monday through Wednesday. But a quick walk around the streets of Tehran, especially its Grand Bazaar, shows the shops are all open and people are busy shopping for their own needs. There are videos circulating on social media purporting to show some shops in Tehran's Grand Bazaar closed. People say, however, that these shopkeepers have closed their shops in fear of vandalism. In some cases, rioters have rendered shopkeepers unable to open their shops by putting glues on their locks. Also, there is news that unknown gunmen have opened fire on some trucks whose drivers were not willing to stop working during the three-day strike. Meanwhile, Iranian Judiciary Chief Ghulam Hossein Mohsen Ejei has warned that those who threaten or force sellers close their shops and join the strike will be identified and prosecuted.
Look around here. All shops are open. Thank God people are doing their daily shopping. This is a message to London-based media outlets. We are Iranians. We love our country and we have unity. What you broadcast on your TV channels are mere lies.
Before coming to the Grand Bazaar for shopping, I had been told that there might be a strike. But as I have walked around the streets, I see no sign of a strike here. I think those who call for strikes are only making fun of themselves because a majority of people do not care about them.
The country has been gripped by riots for 10 weeks now, with the unrest claiming the lives of civilians and security forces.
The Islamic Republic says foreign media outlets are overstating what's going on in Iran to fan the flames of unrest. Officials are now calling on rioters to calm down, warning them against playing into the hands of Iran's enemies. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Pro-Russian officials in Donetsk say six civilians have lost their lives in Ukraine's latest shelling of the city. According to the city's mayor, the rocket and artillery fire targeted residential houses, an indoor market, a shopping mall, a youth center, and a cathedral in downtown Donetsk. There have also been reports of a few injuries. In the meantime, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky visited the frontline region of Donetsk on Tuesday. While meeting with his troops, Zelensky described the east of Ukraine as the most difficult front. Russian authorities accuse Ukrainian forces of heavily shelling Donetsk, but the Ukrainian side denies its aims to harm civilian or civil population. The two sides have intensified their attacks in recent weeks. Moving on, EU finance ministers express frustration with Hungary for blocking billions of euros in financial aid for Ukraine. Hungary is at loggerheads with Brussels over claims Budapest is flouting the bloc's rule of law. Jerome Hughes reports from the EU headquarters in Brussels.
EU leaders are furious with Hungary for blocking an 18 billion euro financial aid package for Ukraine, the first tranche of which is due to be released to Kiev next month. Finance ministers from the 27-nation bloc came together on Tuesday to try and resolve the impasse, but the meeting ended in failure.
Ukraine is a country at war. It desperately needs our support, and we just cannot allow one member state delay and derail this EU financial support.
This debacle follows a European Commission proposal last week to freeze 7.5 billion euro in funding to Hungary from the EU budget amid claims that Budapest is not meeting the bloc's rule of law standards. Aside from Ukraine, EU finance ministers have major problems closer to home. The energy crisis in the EU, resulting from sanctions against Russia, is getting worse by the day. The European Commission warns of economic disaster if EU nations continue to subsidise high energy costs in an ad hoc emergency fashion. Out of control, energy prices are making the cost of living crisis in the EU unbearable for households and businesses. Eurozone inflation is at 10%. The European Central Bank is aggressively increasing interest rates to try and tackle the problem. Economists warn forcing inflation down too quickly can also be dangerous.
Of course, if you have a persistent drop in prices, people might think, well, I'm not going to buy now. I'm not going to spend now because prices will come down. So I'm going to stay with my money in the pockets and wait for later. And of course, you don't have economic activity.
Croatia will become the 20th member of the Eurozone next month. EU finance ministers say Zagreb will be able to enjoy all the benefits. However, the euro has a troubled history, and so it's clear Croatia will also be exposed to potential risks during these incredibly uncertain economic times. Jerome Hughes, the EU finance minister's meeting, Brussels.
Turning elsewhere, the United States and Australia agreed to deepen their military ties, citing shared concerns over China's actions around Taiwan. Following their annual talks, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the U.S. will increase rotations of its air, land, and sea forces to Australia. For now, no details are available about the time of the deployment or the number of troops, ships, and aircraft involved. The two countries have also agreed to invite Japan to boost its military cooperation. Austin cited China's rise around Taiwan, as well as in the East and South China Seas, as the reason for the collaboration. Last year, the United States, Britain, and Australia formed a new military alliance called AUKUS under the pretext of boosting security in the Indo-Pacific. But China says the increased militarization and the build-up of foreign troops in the region is a threat. Democrats seem to have solidified their slim majority in the U.S. Senate, with projections showing the party will win the runoff race in the state of Georgia. Democrat Raphael Warnock is expected to defeat Republican Herschel Walker. Neither candidate was able to get more than 50% of the vote in November's general elections. That means Democrats will gain control of 51 out of the 100 seats that were up for grabs in the Senate. With Republicans landing the majority in the House, the latest win gives President Joe Biden more leverage with his legislative agenda during his next 2 years in office. The results from the Georgia runoff has also delivered a blow to former President Donald Trump, who is seeking to run in the 2024 election. Many of the candidates he had endorsed have ended up losing, including the one in Georgia. Turning now to Argentina, where Vice President Cristina Kirchner has been sentenced to 6 years in prison for corruption. An Argentinian court has also given the former president a lifelong ban on holding public office for a $1 billion fraud case. Kirchner has been found guilty of awarding public work contracts during her presidency between 2007 and 2015. She's dismissed the charges, saying they're politically motivated and unproven lies made up by her enemies. She's unlikely to go to jail as she enjoys immunity due to her government position. The vice president, who is the wife of former President Néstor Kirchner, is expected to appeal the court ruling. And Indigenous Canadians seized the moment at the COP15 Biodiversity Summit to protest against the federal government's crimes against First Nations people. A group of activists disrupted Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's speech at the opening ceremony of the summit in Montreal. They beat drums and unfurled a banner that read, "Indigenous genocide equals ecocide." They called on the government to stop invading their lands if it wants to save biodiversity. Last year, the remains of hundreds of children were found at the sites of former residential schools in Canada. The harrowing discovery has led to demands for accountability. Thousands of Indigenous children vanished at schools mostly run by Catholic Church that aimed to assimilate them during the 19th and 20th centuries.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
Europe has accused the US of profiting from war. EU officials attack Joe Biden over sky-high gas prices, weapon sales, and trade. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT noted, the impact of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine is harsher on the EU than on the US. European Council President Charles Michel has said, according to Michel, security ties between Brussels and Washington have strengthened since the outbreak of Russia-Ukraine conflict, in which the West is backing Kiev. There is unprecedented coordination on the war in Ukraine, he said in an interview with Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera recently. But apparently the same can't be said about economic cooperation, with the European Council head pointing out that the impact of the conflict on the US is not the same as on Europe. Things are easier for America because it is an exporter of energy resources and benefits from spiking gas and oil prices, while the EU has to pay a heavy price, he said. We are at a risk of an economic recession, the bloc's chief added. Michel explained, European industries pay more for energy and face competition from American ones. The European Council president was also asked if he felt betrayed by the Inflation Reduction Act,
passed by the administration of President Joe Biden, which offers huge subsidies and tax breaks to green businesses. Fears have been expressed in Brussels that the scheme could end up luring European businesses to America due to much lower energy prices there. I wouldn't use this term, but I would have preferred another behavior from Washington. Michelle replied, but let's not be naive. The U.S., even under the current administration, prioritizes its own economic interest. Reciprocity and having a level playing field are essential for globalization to work, he said, expressing hope the EU will be able to engage with the US in the coming weeks to discuss mutual cooperation. A report by Politico in late November claimed Brussels was angry at the Biden administration for capitalizing on the fighting in Ukraine. The US is profiting from the conflict the most as they are selling more gas and at higher prices, and because they are selling more weapons, one senior EU official told the outlet. Meanwhile, Politico wrote, Europe accuses US of profiting from war. EU officials attack Joe Biden over sky-high gas prices, weapon sales and trade. Top European officials are furious with Joe Biden's administration and now accuse the Americans of making a fortune from the war, while EU countries suffer. The fact is, if you look at it soberly, the country that is most profiting from this war is the US because they are selling more gas and at higher prices, and because they are selling more weapons, one senior official told Politico. The explosive comments backed in public and private officials, diplomats and ministers elsewhere, follow mounting anger in Europe over American subsidies that threaten to wreck European industry. The Kremlin is likely to welcome the poisoning of the atmosphere among Western allies. The senior EU official said, we are really at a historic juncture, arguing that the double hit of trade disruption from US subsidies and high energy prices risks turning public opinion against both the war effort and the transatlantic alliance. America needs to realize that public opinion is shifting in many EU countries. Another top official, the EU's chief diplomat, Joseph Borrell, called on Washington to respond to European concerns. Americans, our friends, take decisions which have an economic impact on us, he said in an interview with Politico. The US rejected Europe's complaints. The rise in gas prices in Europe is caused by Russia-Ukraine conflict and Putin's energy war against Europe, period, a spokesperson for Biden's National Security Council said. Exports of liquefied natural gas from the US to Europe increased dramatically and enabled Europe to diversify away from Russia, the NSC spokesperson claimed. The biggest point of tension in recent weeks has been Biden's green subsidies and taxes that Brussels says unfairly tilts trade away from the EU and threaten to destroy European industries. Despite formal objections from Europe, Washington has so far shown no sign of backing down. At the same time, the disruption caused by Russia-Ukraine conflict is tipping European economies into recession. With inflation rocketing and a devastating squeeze on energy supplies, threatening blackouts and rationing this winter. As they attempt to reduce their reliance on Russian energy, EU countries are turning to gas from the US instead. But the price Europeans pay is almost four times as high as the same fuel costs in America. Then there is the likely surge in orders for American-made military kits as European armies run short after sending weapons to Ukraine. It's all got too much for top officials in Brussels and other EU capitals. French President Emmanuel Macron said high US gas prices were not friendly, and Germany's economy minister has called on Washington to show more solidarity and help reduce energy costs. Ministers and diplomats based elsewhere in the bloc voiced frustration at the way Biden's government simply ignores the impact of its domestic economic policies on European allies. When EU leaders tackled Biden over high US gas prices at the G20 meeting in Bali last week, the American president simply seemed unaware of the issue, according to the senior official quoted recently. Other EU officials and diplomats agreed that American ignorance about the consequences for Europe was a major problem. The Europeans are discernibly frustrated about the lack of prior information and consultation, said David Kleeman of the Brueghel think tank. Officials on both sides of the Atlantic recognize the risks that the increasingly toxic atmosphere will have for the Western alliance. The bickering is exactly what Putin would wish for. The EU and US diplomats agreed.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ukraine and Russia.
Part 3.
NATO has expanded into 13 countries, up to the borders of Russia. 13 countries.
The focus has to be on not allowing this crisis to turn into hot war between Ukraine and Russia.
Ukraine. It's an ancient and proud land with a rich history filled with much beauty, heroism, and sacrifice. Ukraine is a borderland, a place where east meets west. This is the flag of Ukraine. The blue represents the sky. The gold, its seemingly endless fields of wheat. Ukraine is a prize many have sought, and much blood has spilled in the quest to possess it. Ukraine has been the pathway for Western powers as they attempted to conquer the East. The people's growing discontent made Ukraine more vulnerable to outside forces, and a new kind of warfare was launched, one not known before, the color revolutions.
An NGO is a non-governmental organization. Now, many NGOs are quite legitimate. They represent good causes. Maybe they help people in a country feed or deal with water problems or deal with various kinds of social problems. But there are some NGOs that have become funded by government entities and serve more the purpose of that government rather than trying to serve the people that they are ostensibly working for. One thing we saw in the 1980s, at that point the Central Intelligence Agency had been largely discredited because of scandals that had been exposed in the 1970s.
November 30th of 2013 became the first turning point of Euromaidan and one of its most reported and mysterious events. Incidentally, one such organization, Hromadske TV, received generous donations from the Dutch and U.S. embassies, as well as from the Renaissance Foundation, an NGO founded by George Soros.
I set up a foundation in Ukraine before Ukraine became independent of Russia. And the foundation has been functioning ever since. And it played an important part in events now.
Any good director will tell you that tempo and rhythm are the most essential components to hold an audience's attention. It can also be called a method of betrayal when the allies and followers are relentlessly thrown into the revolutionary flame. The idea is simple. When the preparation work is done, the trigger just needs to be pulled to set the machine into full motion. The murder of politician Rafik Hariri led to the Cedar Revolution. Looking back at the mysterious poisoning of Viktor Yushchenko right before the Orange Revolution of 2004, we see now that he became a sacred victim himself. Most political analysts believe the compassion of the Ukrainian people at that moment tilted the scales, giving him the presidency. Like in 2004 during the Orange Revolution, international leaders felt it necessary to intervene and bring both sides to the negotiating table.
Приехали три министра иностранных дел европейских стран в Киев.
Laurent Fabius, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, Radoslav Sikorsky.
The Ukrainian president and the leaders of the anti-government protests there have agreed on a truce.
The truce was to give talks between President Yanukovych and the opposition a chance.
Just like in 2004, the opposition, or at least its radical faction, the Right Sector, headed by Dmitry Yarosh, had no intention on fulfilling its part of the bargain.
The opposition leaders left saying they may have found a way to end the bloodshed, but they wanted to take the conclusions from their meeting to the people.
It was soon apparent that the people were not happy.
At the same time, Kiev was saying its last goodbyes to the victims of the massacre. It was also welcoming those who came to power at their cost.
Ukraine's parliament has voted for the new speaker of the assembly to become interim president. Alexander Turchynov called on lawmakers to form an interim government by Tuesday. These latest developments follow the dismissal of President Viktor Yanukovych on Saturday.
And they removed Yanukovych, not following the constitutional procedures for impeachment.
The Parliament of Ukraine consists of 450 deputies. The Constitution of Ukraine requires at least a three-fourths majority to vote. In other words, 338 votes in favor of the impeachment. But only 328 deputies voted yes.
The U.S. State Department almost immediately said this was a legitimate government, and that was part of this effort to get regime change. Instead of trying to find some way to revive the February 21st agreement, where maybe you could bring back Yanukovych in some titular way, that became not a possibility anymore. Then you had eastern Ukraine resisting, you had Crimea wanting to break away, and things rapidly escalated.
Voters will decide Sunday whether they'll leave Ukraine and join Russia.
The campaign with the slogan, "Together with Russia," has the backing of Moscow.
Crimean authorities, sensing the mood of the populace, fully supported Viktor Yanukovych's decision to postpone the 2013 European Union Association deal and side deeper ties to Russia. As the events in Kiev took their course, Crimean authorities issued a declaration, putting into words the fears of its people. Based on the will of the Crimeans who elected us, we declare that we will not give Crimea to extremists and neo-Nazis seeking to seize power in Ukraine at the cost of the blood of the country and its citizens. After the regime change in Kiev, rumors began spreading in Crimea that the new authorities would be merciless to those that opposed them.
Slava Ukraini!
This led to the pro-Russian demonstrations rejecting the new government in Kiev. On February 27th, the government buildings in the capital of Crimea were seized by pro-Russian protesters. The current Crimean government was dismissed, and the new leader, Sergei Aksyonov, was assigned as the leader of the Crimean Autonomous Republic. On March 16th, the Crimean referendum was held, and the people voted to leave Ukraine and enter the Russian Federation.
The situation in Crimea is being presented as a Russian invasion. And again, nobody who looks at this seriously and looks at the poll numbers, some of the poll numbers done by the U.S. government agencies themselves, showing that the people of Crimea preferred being part of Russia. In the U.S. news media, it has all been presented as the Russians invaded, they then staged a sham election with people with guns at their backs. Somehow they faked the ballot boxes to get 96% approval for rejoining Russia.
The idea of a referendum in Crimea is just quite simply unconstitutional.
But it does raise questions on whether this vote really is free and fair, especially given the heavy military presence in Crimea right now, Errol.
So that's how it's been sold to the American people. The reality is very different.
The atmosphere here certainly is electric. Thousands of people who've gathered in the capital Crimean city of Simferopol, all of this following a referendum held last Sunday in which the majority of people here overwhelmingly voted in support of being reunited with Russia.
As long ago as 1804, Sevastopol's naval base became the main military port of the Russian Empire on the Black Sea. During the Second World War, the heroic defense of Sevastopol lasted almost a year and took hundreds of thousands of lives. Therefore, the naval base in Crimea has a legacy of historical pride for the Russian Black Sea Fleet, as well as being of huge strategic importance.
Those of us alive back then remember when there were Soviet missiles put into Cuba, how frightened Americans were and how angry, and how we almost went to a nuclear confrontation over having weapons of that kind of destruction placed that close to the United States.
If the United States considers Cuba to be in its backyard, then Crimea lays at Russia's doorstep. In early spring of 2014, eastern Ukraine was also buzzing with protests against the new authorities in Kiev. This region, with the population close to Russia geographically and culturally, feared that the ultra-right leanings of the newly formed government would bring neo-nationalism to their lands. And they had their reasons. The status of the Russian language in Ukraine has been a stumbling block for many years.
Implementing Russian as a second state language was one of the main campaign promises of President Viktor Yanukovych.
In 2012, the Yanukovych government passed a law making it the second official language in the southern and eastern parts of Ukraine, the areas where the Russian-speaking population makes up a majority. Ukrainian nationalist groups initiated massive protests opposing the law. An observing viewer might see some familiar faces there. On February 23, 2014, the very next day after the regime change, the new government voted for an annulment of the official status of the Russian language. And even though later this decision was vetoed by the acting president, Alexander Turchynov, it still sent a message, and a powerful one. This alarmed the Russian-speaking cities of eastern Ukraine, and people took to the streets to show their disagreement. In response, pro-Maidan groups conducted their own demonstrations. When the two parties would meet, it was always tense, and eventually it led to tragedy. One person died and over 50 people were wounded in clashes during a pro-Russian march protesting the new government in Kiev. On April 6th, the Crimean scenario began repeating in eastern Ukraine, where protesters seized government buildings. And the next day, April 7th, they proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic. Kiev replied by announcing the beginning of an anti-terrorist operation in eastern Ukraine. By that time, the international media was screaming about a Russian invasion in Ukraine.
Russia could now be on the verge of invading Ukraine.
But strong words stayed only in the media. The Ukrainian authorities never announced a warlike situation. Why? IMF cannot give money to countries engaged in ongoing war, Petro Poroshenko. Too much money was already invested in Ukraine to stop halfway.
We've invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals that will ensure a secure and prosperous and democratic Ukraine.
Obviously, the funds had to keep coming, and the conflict had to keep going. Getting more and more bloody and deadly, as parties from both sides were using more sophisticated and lethal weapons. The world seemed too busy welcoming this new democracy in Kiev to notice what was being done as it spread its wings over the country. Many in southern Ukraine had been viewing the revolution with concern. And an anti-Maidan movement formed in the city of Odessa in early January 2014. The protesters set up their camp in front of the Trade Union House, a building which would soon become a monument to a massacre of its own. It's difficult to overestimate the importance of Odessa. It is strategically located on the Black Sea, and it's Ukraine's largest seaport. It's not surprising that Ukraine's new authorities were watching the situation unfolding there with growing alarm. More and more of Odessa's people were joining the anti-Maidan movement at the same time as events in eastern Ukraine were heating up. The new Ukrainian government didn't have the power to wage war on too many fronts. If Odessa were to join the growing uprising in the eastern regions, it would seriously complicate the situation. This rebellion had to be extinguished immediately and at any cost, and that cost was high. On May 2, 2014, soccer fans flocked to the center of Odessa City for the Ukrainian championship match. Surprisingly, a great number of these fans who descended into Odessa just the night before also turned out to be fighters from the Maidan self-defense units, along with members of radical organizations from all parts of Ukraine. These fans, masked, armed, and shouting nationalist mottos, began disturbances in the center of the city as they marched to the anti-Maidan tent encampment, where they attacked. The anti-Maidan protesters sought shelter in the Trade Union House, but it was a trap. Maidan supporters started throwing Molotov cocktails into the building until it was engulfed in flames. People burned to death inside, or, trying to escape, jumped from the windows. Although a fire station was less than a mile away, it took almost half an hour for firefighters to arrive. When they finally did, the damage had been done. But here's an intriguing fact. Just a few days before those dreadful events, a messenger from Maidan, Andriy Peruby, made a visit to Odessa. It's an interesting coincidence that some of the people he met with in Odessa were seen at the scene that fateful day. But not everyone was mourning.
On the popular political talk show, Schuster Live, the news about the people burnt alive in Odessa was welcomed with a long round of applause. On its Facebook page, the Right Sector announced the events of May 2nd, a proud moment in national history. An official investigation into this sad event has been going on now for nearly 2 years, and it's yet to reach a conclusion. But it seems the experts had all the information they needed from the very beginning. It looks like Odessa really is a very important piece of real estate, as it was honored with a very special new governor appointed on May 30th of 2015. Mikhail Saakashvili, an old friend of the United States and born and raised in Ukraine's neighboring country, Georgia.
A little hoedown there in Georgia.
A quick look at his biography gives one an understanding that he's been groomed for a special mission. Mr. Saakashvili received a U.S. State Department scholarship, and he worked for a New York law firm which represented the organization Kamara, a group that appeared earlier when we learned about the color revolutions.
We are dealing with democratic, bloodless revolution.
This is the Revolution of Roses. And this is Mikhail Saakashvili with Kamara, busy overthrowing the legitimately elected president, Eduard Shevardnadze. Soon after the Rose Revolution blossomed fully, Georgia announced its intentions to join NATO and plant fresh NATO military bases in the fertile soil right on Russia's border.
Never ever we will give our freedom and independence. Never ever will give any piece of our territory.
Saakashvili's mission was accomplished. At least with his friends in NATO. The Georgian populace wasn't quite as happy, though. In 2007, they took to the streets to voice discontent. And Mr. Saakashvili responded with force. The people's discontent grew. Saakashvili's party lost parliamentary elections, and the opposition took control.
He said, "This means that the parliamentary majority should set up a new government and me as the president, according to our constitution."
Mikhail decided not to wait for the results of the president's election and fled the country in October 2013. In 2014, Saakashvili refused summons to appear in court as a witness in several criminal cases. Later that same year, he was accused of misuse of power and embezzlement. Saakashvili wound up in the U.S., and soon his friends in Washington found him a new assignment. Mikhail actively supported Maidan, and very soon was rewarded with a high position in the new Ukrainian government. First as the president's counselor, and then as the governor of Odessa. The day before taking this position, he renounced his citizenship to Georgia, the country of his birth, and became a Ukrainian citizen. As they say, the battle is worth the blood, both literally and figuratively. Jeffrey Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, paid a visit to Saakashvili just a month after he took office in Odessa.
But as long as the Oblast administration is delivering results on Ukraine, you are going to see a steady flow of embassy and Washington visitors coming here.
The meeting was fruitful, and Jeffrey, generous. No matter how well Saakashvili's job goes, it looks like he shouldn't be worried about his own finances. On his Facebook page, he posted an official document showing that the new governor of Odessa gets a pretty penny from Washington, almost $200,000 a year. For comparison, the governor of Maine gets $70,000 a year. So if Odessa became a new U.S. state, it would be at the top of the list. Mr. Saakashvili should feel right at home in his newly adopted country. He is best of friends with fellow color revolutionary leader Viktor Yushchenko, who's the godfather of his son. A war, once launched, doesn't choose its victims.
We are just learning at this hour that Malaysian Airlines has now confirmed that it has lost contact with one of its planes.
The plane was indeed shot down by a missile while flying at a high altitude over eastern Ukraine near the Russian border.
298 revised number of souls on board, all feared dead.
It was a murder. It was a crime. There's been this odd nonchalance about pursuing the answers. There was a report, a very limited report, put out a few months after the event, But since then, they said the next report will be on the first anniversary of the event. But you deal with a criminal investigation before it becomes a cold case. So there's been this curious element of why is there not greater pressure from both the media and the Western governments to answer these questions.
But even without any answers, the fingers were pointed immediately.
That's not an accident. That is happening because of Russian support. Evidence indicates that the plane was shot down by a surface-to-air missile that was launched from an area that is controlled by Russian-backed separatists inside of Ukraine.
The Malaysian Boeing wasn't the first plane to play a significant part in American-Russian relationships. On September 1, 1983, Korean Airlines Flight 007 from New York to Seoul via Anchorage was shot down by a Soviet interceptor aircraft over the territory of the USSR in the Sea of Japan.
There was absolutely no justification, either legal or moral, for what the Soviets did.
The tragedy of the Korean Boeing was considered a perfect occasion to demonstrate the NATO military power within dangerous proximity to the Soviets. On November 2, 1983, NATO launched Able Archer, a 10-day command post exercise simulating a conflict escalation, culminating in a nuclear attack. It was followed by placing Pershing II nuclear missiles in Europe. What Reagan didn't take into consideration was the paranoid overreaction of the Soviets. A recently declassified U.S. intelligence report shows that for the first time since the Cuban Missile Crisis, the world was that close to nuclear war. Just like in 1983, the Malaysian Boeing crash was leveraged against the enemy. A new wave of sanctions hit Russia immediately after the tragedy.
The United States is imposing new sanctions in key sectors of the Russian economy.
Almost a year and 3 months later, the Dutch Safety Board published a report.
Ladies and gentlemen, flight MH17 crashed because of a 9N314M warhead detonated outside the aeroplane above the left side of the cockpit.
The report didn't blame any specific group or person and estimated a very wide area of 320 kilometers as a zone from which the missile was fired. At the same time, the Russian producer of Buk missiles, Almazante, conducted its own independent investigation. During the experiment, they blew up a retired airliner with a Buk missile and came to the conclusion that the Malaysian plane was brought down by the older type of missiles, not used by Russia anymore, but still in the possession of Ukraine. The company claims that the missile was launched from the territory controlled by the Ukrainian military. One would expect that these controversial results would again stir up public interest in the investigation, but the tragedy of Malaysian flight MH17 had already played its role in the big geopolitical game. Therefore, it was soon forgotten. The goal was achieved. After the third wave of sanctions hit Russia, the tensions between the two countries skyrocketed. So the question presents itself. Are we truly witnessing the beginning of Cold War 2.0? And if so, what are our chances to survive at this time? In 1947, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists introduced the Doomsday Clock. It represents a countdown to global nuclear annihilation. In 1953, during the height of the Cold War, it came its closest to midnight as the superpowers were creating massive nuclear arsenals.
This is the story of America's ever-expanding atomic weapons program.
As the world began to grasp the insane danger of nuclear warfare and took measures to control the arms race, the situation steadily improved. In 1991, the Doomsday Clock was at its furthest from midnight, 17 minutes. That time of hope was short-lived, though, as the world has become more and more unstable. But in 2015, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists moved the clock to just 3 minutes to midnight.
Today, unchecked climate change and a nuclear arms race resulting from modernization of huge arsenals pose extraordinary and undeniable threats to the continued existence of humanity.
The United States and Russia have embarked on massive programs to modernize their nuclear arsenals, undermining existing nuclear weapons treaties. The clock ticks now at just 3 minutes to midnight because international leaders are failing to perform their most important duty, ensuring and preserving the health and vitality of human civilization.
In the limelight.
The Western regime's double standard on human rights is not surprising. While the British regime condemns the situation of human rights in other countries, it has recently given new powers to the police to crack down people's protests and strikes. Actually, the leaders of Western regimes are now presenting their desired definition of rioting and protesting after classifying terrorism.